Welcome, everyone. The first item on our agenda is approval of the agenda. Are there any changes? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. The next item on our agenda are the minutes, acceptance of the minutes from April 23rd, 2019 meeting. Are there any changes? Hearing none, the minutes are approved.
Do we have any more?
Is Amy Neal here?
Not
Chris
yet.
Is here? Chris? The next item on our agenda is the posthumous degree for Jackson Weller. We'll hear from Chris Baca, the manager of student success.
Can I just stay where I am?
That's fine.
Okay. I have prepared a statement to ensure that I don't speak for 20 minutes, as I tend to do, but also to ensure that I honor this young man and don't forget any of the pieces that I'd like to share with you all today. As Dr. Coleman stated, my name is Chris Baca. I'm the Associate Athletic Director for Student Development here at UNM. I've had the pleasure of collaborating with so many of you regarding the academic endeavors of several of our student athletes. I'm very appreciative of the efforts you all make to give our students the skills, knowledge, and accountability they need as they seek degrees and begin their lives as a member of this or another community. We have students from a very wide range of abilities, and you find ways to connect with them, whether it is through guiding them through the process of analyzing and presenting research, as Dr. Ryan Swanson has done, providing educational opportunities that eliminate career paths, as did you this summer, Dr. Coleman, or simply introducing new ideas that light a spark within them, as has Dr. Serna, who is my advisor and probably wondering where I've been because I haven't written a dissertation yet. Kathy Clifton, who teaches an FYE X class specifically for student athletes. Dr. Martin Jones, Dr. Rocha. Dr. Martin Jones. I was just saying your name. He felt himself announced. Dr. Rocha, Dr. Richardson, and countless others of you who have worked with our students to help them to earn degrees. I hope that you know that from our perspective, you all change lives. Those of us who work in higher education know that the greatest fortune we have is that we do get the opportunity to make a real palpable difference in our students' life paths. But we are also changed through knowing them, such is the case for Jackson Weller. Jackson first came into my office in July of 2018 as a new transfer student athlete on the baseball team. We met briefly to discuss his plans for both the semester and beyond, and after he left, I honestly was not too certain about him. He was too nice. I later found out that his teammates had the same reaction, that there was no way that this was who Jackson was. But as I got to know him better over the following months, that is exactly who Jackson was. We had many conversations about his future plans, and although he was still figuring things out, there were some things he was set on. He wanted to graduate. He wanted to help other young people who had dreams of elite athleticism to reach their goals. He wanted to take care of his friends and his family. In the fall of 2018, he earned a 3.5 GPA while taking 18 credit hours and maintaining a rigorous training schedule. He came to see me after winter break with the sad news that he had sustained an injury. However, even when faced with a season-ending injury, Jackson remained positive and motivated. It is certainly not uncommon for student-athletes' grades to suffer when they're working through an injury, but that was not the case for Jackson. I continued to meet with him throughout the spring 2019 semester, and he was doing very well in his classes, rehabbing from surgery and preparing to play summer ball in anticipation of returning to full strength for the 2020 baseball season. The last time we met was 2 weeks before he was killed. He was excited about a reunion of sorts he was having with other students from his CJ317 class. They'd been on a retreat that he had initially been dreading, but the experience had created a new group of friends that he did not otherwise have known. Just a few days later, he was gone. One of the new friends he had made in that class, a man who's an international student, came to our offices 2 days after to grieve with us. He, like so many of the rest of us, lamented that our time with Jackson was so short. When Jackson's family was removing his things from his apartment, they found a 16-point list of his long-term goals. A rise to top hope. Head baseball coach Ray Birmingham shared a picture of it with me that hangs in my office. Number one on that list was to become a professional baseball player. Number two, graduate with a master's degree. Thank you very much for your time today. Unfortunately, time is something Jackson did not have. He was not able to accomplish all of his life goals because that time was stolen from him. Fifth on his list was to make a lasting impact on the world. He certainly made a lasting impact on me, his coaches, his teammates, and the countless others he befriended during his short time at UNM. It is only fitting that we give his family, friends, and everyone who loved him the opportunity to see his potential honored for a posthumous degree. I'm very hopeful that his parents and sister might have the small joy of seeing his name on a diploma from UNM. I do want to leave you with this. Jackson was everything I've described him as: studious, positive, hardworking, ethical. However, he was also fully embracing the life of a college student. The last item on his list, number 16, was have lit parties. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do I have a motion regarding this posthumous degree?
So moved.
Move to approve the posthumous degree for Jackson Rutland.
Do I have a second?
Seconded.
It's been moved and seconded that we approve a posthumous degree for Jackson Weller. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll move to a vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion carries. Thank you, Chris. I believe you'll need to go ahead if you have the slips and record that on your slip there.
Would that be action item one?
It would actually be three.
Three. Okay.
Yeah. The next item on our agenda is the president's report. Before I go into that report, first of all, I'd like to thank all of our new. Can you raise your hand if you're a new faculty senator? Thank you for agreeing to serve. And our returning faculty senators, your hands up. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And I want to say a couple of public thanks. The first is to Kennedy Hubbard and her team and the remarkable work that they've done over the summer to help me get prepared, and I know they've helped other folk get prepared. And so thank you so much, Kennedy. Thank you, Rick. It's Felicia here, other folk who've been here. So thank you for your help getting everything together. I want to offer a special thanks to my colleague, Pamela Pyle. I have to tell you, I know that I'm not going to be able to do the things that Pamela was able to do as faculty senate president. I'll do my best to fill her shoes. Just her wealth.
They're high heels, you know.
I can't do the heels. I've tried that. And her shoe size is a little small for me. But I want to thank Pamela because a lot of the things that I think that we're going to be able to accomplish this year, frankly, simply wouldn't be possible were it not for the hard work, the stick-to-itiveness, and the courage. So... All right. We're in a much better position for your leadership. I'd like to introduce the new members of our operations committee, so that we can put faces with names. You see the names here, but if we could start at this end of the table and we'll work our way down so people can know, especially our new faculty members who are our new operations committee is. Please.
So I'm returning, Nancy Lopez, and I'm professor of sociology. I also direct the Institute for the Study of Race and Social Justice.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Robert Valdez. I'm one of those weird characters who actually has two appointments. I'm a professor of family and community medicine in the Health Science Center and professor of economics in the rest of the university.
Brandy Fink, returning ops committee member, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. I'm also the Health Sciences Council chair.
I'd actually like you to introduce yourself as well, Adam.
My name is Adam Hathaway. I'm a professional registered parliamentarian.
Adam is on board this semester to help me to learn the ropes. He's actually convinced me that I'm going to actually train to become a parliamentarian myself. So in the future, maybe I can get paid to do that as well. I don't know. But thank you, Adam. Adam's also been very helpful in helping me to get my feet on the ground in terms of procedure and the like. And I'm Finney Coleman, the president of VACWA Center from the English department.
Pamela Pyle, past president times four, and College of Fine Arts is my going back to place.
Rebecca Blakely, Radiologic Sciences Director and returning faculty member. And yeah, that's it.
And then
I'm Rick Holmes, Office of the Secretary, not on us.
And we also have, for those of you who don't know, Kennedy, would you please let people see you there?
Hello.
Kennedy.
See you.
Kennedy Hubbard is our University Secretary. And we're also blessed to have with us today the chair of our Committee on Governments, Sever Bordeno. Please, Sever. Thank you. So there is some consternation afoot, right? It appears that we may not, except in special circumstances as a body, be a body that is creating public policy. And since we are not a public body, there's some questions whether or not we are subject to the Open Meetings Act. However, after some discussion in our operations meeting, we intend to comply with the Open Meetings Act, even if we aren't required by law to do so. We will continue to post our agendas on the Friday before so that we have plenty of time so people can understand. But if we miss something, don't go calling the Attorney General because we may not be in trouble at all, right? So we'll get an official read from University Counsel. I spoke with her yesterday. She seems pretty convinced that we are not subject to the Open Meetings Act. We'll get some better guidance or concrete guidance from her. She'll send us a blurb that we can put up whether we are or we're not. But we'll continue with our current standard. COG, one of the things that we've done, you've noticed this year, we've moved our election process a little bit, shifted it around so that hopefully by the end of our spring semester, we know who our committee chairs are, so that when we go into the fall, we're not having that first meeting of the year where we don't know who's going to be in charge, et cetera. And also, there's business to conduct over the summer. Often, we need to have reads from committees and the like. So we're going to continue to work on that. When we make those adjustments, we'll make sure that we follow, you know, send things through the policy channels that are appropriate to make sure that we're by the book in everything that we do. One of the things that I want to bring up is the spring election of the officers. So there was some consternation about how the vote was handled. We took that to COG. COG took it under consideration, explored in depth what happened in that election, and has validated the results of that election. There will be that memorandum on file with the university secretary for any of those who need to see that. But we felt it important to acknowledge that so that if anyone who had questions about that process, we let you know that we have addressed that. One of my priorities over the summer was to connect with branch campuses. And we had one meeting set up out at Gallup, and I wound up with some conflicts and didn't get a chance to make it out there. But my goal is to reach each of our branch campuses over the next month or so. And the idea being we have to do a better job of working, connecting with our branch campuses. We have a report later on that idea is going to come up again. Dean searches. These are the searches that are out. We have four that are going on this academic year. I'm not sure what the order is going to be. I'm sure that they'll ask us for representation on those different search committees. But these are the four deans who will be conducting those searches. The Regents meeting. I actually want to skip to the second one. I am stunned at the change in tone in the Regents meeting. Right? I really do believe that, again, and I hate to keep putting you on the spot, but I think the courage that this body showed in standing up to the regents, I think has curbed some of that behavior that we did not want to see from our regents. It helps also that we have new regents there. It's just it's night and day, and I'm very appreciative of that, and I think we're going to get a great deal done with this set of regents. They've changed the number of their meetings, and they had I know that the press kind of reported it as regents chopped the number of meetings in half. They had a much more thoughtful rationale for why they did that. The cost of setting up those meetings, the strain that it puts on faculty and staff to, you know, put those meetings together and the like, I thought it was a very thoughtful response. I don't know if I would have agreed to cut it down to 6. I might have gone to 8. But I understood their rationale and appreciated it. The third item under the Regents meeting, there's $1 million allocated from the Regents Endowment Fund. Now, I know that there are folk who go, well, we should not be pulling money out of the endowment. Regent Schwartz made that exact same argument. And frankly, I agree with him, too. You're using your seed corn. But this year, rather than bail out, say, athletics with that money, they used it to support these things, right? So $650,000 went to the Grand Challenges, and our own Brandy Fink is involved in one of those. And it's, at some point, I think this new body needs to see that presentation that you made. It is a remarkable set of projects that are coming from our faculty, our research. So $650,000 went to support that, and then $350,000 to these enrollment management initiatives. Now, we, during that meeting, and this is going to pop up on the screen again, but I'll just mention it here. The president had been told that there would be the indicators looked like there was a 3% increase in the number of incoming freshmen. Since then, I think those numbers have changed. I don't think we're going to, there's something afoot. We're some students short of what we needed to have that 3%. So even though it's been reported out as that, the initial indicators, we aren't out of the woods yet with that. The graduate music performance certificate was approved, and they formed an ad hoc governance committee. My dear colleague, Joy Harjo, when I first came to UNM, she was in the English department here. How we let her go is still a mystery to me, but she is now the poet laureate. I don't know if you've been in the library to see the Orwell, exhibition? Mm-hmm. But Russ Davidson donated his entire collection of George Orwell books, including original copies of 1984, et cetera. It's a fascinating collection. There's a 3% increase in enrollment that I mentioned a second ago. The unionization vote dates, those will be in October. I believe it's the second week in October. As that firms up, I think we said it was the... I'm not going to speculate. 16th and 17th. So that unionization vote will be on the 16th and 17th, and I'm encouraging everyone to go out and participate in learning as much as we can about unionization and vote your mind. IPRA. So I've kind of debated on this, but I think I need to raise an alarm that may not need to be raised. This summer, over the summer, our athletics council was asked to provide the handwritten notes for the exit interviews for our student athletes. We had always been told, and I chaired the athletics council for 3 years myself, and we were told that as long as you held those notes, and they were in preparation for a larger report, then they were not IPRA-able, if we can create a new word, right? I think we said IPRA-able.
IPRA-able.
That is no longer the guidance. And so our athletics council was forced to turn over their handwritten notes to this reporter. Now, you can imagine what would happen if you were in a discussion as a faculty member about whether or not you're going to allow someone to go along to their third year review, or if you're in a tenure promotion discussion and that person doesn't like what came out of it, they could essentially IPRA that meeting, and anything that you wrote handwritten would also be made available to that person. Now, we think that's a slippery slope, and we think the university at some point has to go, no, we're not going to, that's a bridge too far. We're having other meetings with the university council, the idea being eventually we might even have to go to the attorney general for clarification. But like I said, I don't want to raise that alarm, but I feel I have to mention why that's floating out there. So that if you hear things about it, you're not, well, why didn't the ops tell us that this was afoot, right? So hopefully in the meetings that come, we'll get a a different reading on the law, and we'll see how that goes. We still have. Yeah, I'm going to die.
Oh,
in terms of
that's
power.
What I'm saying. His battery says low.
So oh, you might I thought you meant where is this thing connected?
Yeah, no. I had a legitimate reading.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Technical difficulties.
Just don't want us to die there, right? Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. So that's the president's report. Our next, we have our consent agenda. We have three items on that agenda.
Them together separately.
The first is our summer degree candidates. I was going to just do the consent agenda.
Yeah.
Right. So we have the summer 2019 degree candidates. We have the faculty senate commitment appointments and membership approval. We could jump over to the webpage if you need to see that. And then we have this Form C. Is there any discussion?
Cindy, clarify something. In your agenda, it says 5, 7, 8, but it's...
Oh, I'm sorry. It should be 4, 5, and 6. I'm sorry.
It's not you. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry about that, everybody.
All right?
No, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, should be 5, 6, and 7.
It should be 5, 6, and 7. But this is... Yeah. I don't know how this got...
Right. But we'll have to do 4, 5, 6, because
yeah.
That's what you got here.
Okay. So, can I borrow that?
Yeah,
please?
Go for it.
So, action item number 4. I think I want to just have a move to a vote on each of these. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
So would 4 be summer 2019 degree?
Yeah. So action item number 4, summer 2019 degree candidates. Do I have a motion to approve those candidates?
So moved. Seconded.
Okay, you have to state what it is, the motion that you're putting on the floor for me.
The motion to approve the summer 2019 degree candidates.
Do I have a second?
Seconded.
It has been motioned and seconded that we approve the summer 2019 degree candidates. All those in favor?
Any discussion?
Oh, excuse me. Is there any discussion? No discussion? All those in, oh, there is discussion. Oh, there is a discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, ayes have it. Action item number 5 is the 2019-2020 Faculty Senate Committee Appointments and Membership Approval. Do I have a motion to approve those committee selections?
Do you want to put it up there so we can
see? I don't know if I can.
Okay.
Guide me, Rick.
Where would it be on the Senate website?
So, where are we going to?
Scroll up a little bit, and then go to the right and click on August 27th, 2019, one down.
This one?
Yes.
Okay.
And then click on the agenda, the top one. Scroll down, and then there's the committee appointments right there.
Okay. Are we able to see those? Probably not. So admissions, registration, athletics council, budget, business council, curricula. These are all available to you online. But these will be the appointments for this fall. May I have a motion from the body? Yes.
Motion to approve, the Faculty Senate Committee appointment and membership.
Do I have a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we will approve the 2019-2020 Faculty Senate Committee appointment and membership. Do I have any discussion? We'll move to the vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Ayes have it.
Oh, my goodness, I thought she raised her hand. She's okay.
Okay, I'm sorry. Action item number 6 our Form C. Let me see if I can go back to my present mode here. The Form C from the Faculty Senate Curricula Committee. This is for the Form C for MSN Nursing Concentration Nurse Midwifery. Do I have a motion from the floor regarding action item number 6?
Motion to approve Form C of the MSN Nursing Concentration Nurse Midwifery.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. It has been moved and seconded that we approve the MSN Nursing Concentration Nurse Midwifery. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll move to the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Those are all the items on our consent agenda. Thank you. The next topic on our agenda is the U.S. and Global Diversity and Inclusion Requirement, the Student Learning Outcomes Assessment Pilot, and Dr. Nancy Lopez will address us regarding that matter.
So thank you for putting this on the agenda. I wanted to use this opportunity to invite you and your constituents to participate in the first assessment of the U.S. and Global Diversity and Inclusion that is going to be taking place over a four-year period. So we're basically doing a pilot for this year, 2019 to 2020, but it will continue for the next 3 years. We have a total of 177 classes that satisfy this requirement, and our goal is to assess each class at least once during this four-year period. So the objective is to really focus on the required learning outcomes that you have included in your packet. So there's four required learning outcomes, and each class that has been listed of the 177 has met two of those learning outcomes. And I'll just give an example, like demonstrate an ability to view issues from multiple perspectives, as well as analyze, evaluate, and interpret one's history and position in contemporary U.S. society, as well as in a global context. And a second one, just as an example, is understand the dynamics of historic and contemporary inequality, oppression, and resistance from marginalized groups in a local and global societies, and how these dynamics shape individual and community power and experiences sexism, institutional racism, homophobia, and so on. So what I'm asking each of you to do is to share this information with your departments, your constituents, that there is a pilot. Our goal is to reach 10% of those classes, so about 17 to 20 classes. Ideally, we would have more. And you have the assessment tool that we will be using to look at student learning outcomes broadly defined. So the big message I want you to convey to your constituents is this is not an evaluation of a specific course. This is an evaluation of the overall U.S. and global diversity and inclusion requirement at the University of New Mexico that we implemented over 5-6 years ago. And we hope that these assessments will be shared with your community of practice to enhance student learning success across your departments, across your disciplines, across your colleges. So it is an opportunity for us to share best practices. So some of the different examples of materials that you could include in the assessment are, say, you assign presentations or reflections or group projects. Maybe there's a policy brief. Maybe there's just a traditional exam that you give a midterm. So you could use that rubric to assess, okay, this student or this learning outcome has been met. There's evidence of this. There's partial evidence. There's adequate. There's comprehensive and exemplary evidence that this learning outcome has been met. If you have any questions, members of the Diversity Council Curriculum Committee, myself included, along with a number of members of the committee, would be more than happy to do one-on-one consultations. We hope that you can give us feedback on this pilot. Again, we're only piloting it with about a 10% sample, but as I mentioned, this is a three-year endeavor that will actually evaluate every single course at some point in the next 3 years. Next year, it's 90% sample, right? So we hope that you can include this as service as service as part of your annual review reporting under contributions to teaching, contributions to equity and inclusion, university service, and or for your academic program review. So I hope that this is an opportunity that not only, you know, helps the Diversity Council strengthen this learning outcome, but also that can be meaningful for your own program. If you're interested in volunteering, please do consult with your chair or whoever the program director is and confirm your participation as soon as possible, hopefully no later than October 10th for the fall. But again, this pilot continues for the entire year, so by March 10th for the spring 2020. If any of you are teaching courses that are not on the list, you see the list of 177 courses that was included in the information packet. I also want you to convey an invitation not only to participate in the assessment, but also to submit syllabi that will be reviewed by the curriculum. And again, I want to stress that the learning outcomes include not only gender, disability, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religion, or other marginalized group, race, ethnicity, etc. So it covers an enormous variety of not only disciplines, but also subject areas. There's a lot more that I can say, but I do want to emphasize how we really don't want this to be a paper-checking exercise, but really an opportunity for dialogues in your department about how these learning outcomes could enhance student success. I think you're all familiar with the idea that there's a long body of literature that shows that not only do these learning outcomes enhance student success for underrepresented students, but for all students, critical thinking skills, writing skills, communication skills, etc. So there is a body of literature that shows that these kind of learning outcomes actually enhance student success and change what people do in the world. So with that, I'll end and entertain any questions and invite you to email me, Nancy Lopez, nlopez@unm.edu. And again, if there are courses that you teach that are not on the list and you want them considered, go to diverse.unm.edu, page down, you'll see U.S. and Global Diversity, and you can email your syllabus with the checklist on the student learning outcomes that are being met in your course, and it will be reviewed by the committee, usglobaldiversity@unm.edu.
Are there any comments or questions from the body?
Nancy, I have a question. So you had talked about sharing our assessments with our faculty or students, and
yes.
When would we see those assessments? Would that be the end of this academic year going forward?
So our hope is that right now we have about a dozen people who have expressed interest and are implementing these assessments in their courses. So they would share it with us whenever they finish. So say for whatever reason you've assessed that in your first month of teaching, maybe it's midterm, maybe it's finals, you would send it to us, you would keep a copy of that, and we would share with you what we analyzed for that semester, what were some of the findings. So our hope is that, yes, by the end of the year, we would have a collective analysis of the student learning outcomes and any information that we can share with you.
And that would be on the website then, diverse.unm.edu?
Yes.
Okay.
So the assessment tool should be there. I didn't double check. You know, we were just recently developing this over the summer, but this has been a long time coming. As you know, the requirement's been in place for almost 6 years, so this is something that we need to do to really see whether or not we're meeting our learning outcomes. Again, for your faculty, stress that this is not evaluating their class. It is every single class that's listed will be evaluated at some point. So whether you participate in the pilot or the larger, but we do welcome feedback on the tool itself. Maybe there are suggestions for improving it once we roll it out for the next 3 years. This is just the pilot. But we welcome additional. More than 20 would be great.
Any further comment? Questions? Hearing none, we'll move to the next agenda item, which is our faculty governance retreat report. I need to give apologize up front for what's going to probably be a fairly long-winded introduction to this. Each member of the operations committee has a section in that report that they will report back on. But I wanted to start off, again, thanking everyone for your support over the summer, for those of you who helped me out when I called and said, hey, can you help me with this question or that? Thank you all for helping. The first thing that when I came into onto the Faculty Senate is that I noticed we have a very vertical leadership structure, and that is out of for historical reasons, not bound up in any individual person, right? So this is something that over time we kind of built as an institution. I think, however, this year is an opportunity for us to flatten that leadership structure out a little bit more, make it more horizontal, and pass more responsibility down to individual members of our councils, our committees, etc., right? So the first thing that I did was I put together an advisory team, and I have a couple of members of that team together. Fran is here. Thank you, Fran, for working on that team with me. A group of people who sat with me to kind of just think through the academic year, to think through kind of our priorities, and for us not to miss this really remarkable opportunity that we have to kind of have even more of an impact on our institution's governance. To improve faculty governance. Of course, we're at a moment when there's a lot of flux still. We have a lot of new leaders on campus. We have four new deans coming in, et cetera. So that advisory team helped me a great deal. And the first thing that we talked about was that kind of vertical leadership structure. We needed to set and develop a clear set of priorities for our Faculty Senate. One of the things that I hope that we can do is to develop an agenda that guides our efforts throughout the academic year, and that agenda culminating in an annual report that actually is going to probably, in terms of date, hinge on the Athletics Council's final report of the year. And then using that not to so much tell us what we've done, but to look forward at what it is that we hope to accomplish as a faculty, and that we're sharing that information out with our colleagues. So the first thing was to develop this a more effective communication strategy, this bi-directional flow of communications. We need to secure more resources for faculty-centered initiatives. Right now, we're broke. I mean, poor Kennedy, I'm like asking her to go to the hawk shop on every other day. But we need resources as a faculty to actually pursue the initiatives that come out of this body, out of this faculty senate. We don't have those resources at hand. So we're going to try to do what we can to find those additional resources. As I mentioned before, it is imperative that we improve our interactions with our branch campuses and really start thinking about our academic institution more broadly speaking. We also need to allow this body to become a more deliberative body. So my pledge to the Faculty Senate is we will not put items on the agenda and then have you vote on them right then and there. That's except for the consent agenda items, things like that. If there's an initiative, my idea is that we'll present that information to you, and at the next Faculty Senate meeting, we won't have to have a debate about it because you'll have had time to digest the information, share it with your colleagues, get feedback from them, and then come back and represent our faculty in your vote. Does that make sense? So becoming a more deliberative body. I've worked over the summer with COG and AF&T to talk about how we can work more collaboratively together. Sever has become my emergency ride home. So, you know, we've talked about a lot of stuff, and he gets to take home peaches. Anybody wants peaches? I got tons of peaches. I don't know. Come on, peaches. But we think that we want to build and demonstrate to the administration that there is no daylight between AF&T, COG, and Faculty Senate. That there is no daylight there. And where there's daylight, we as a group, as professionals, have to work to clear that up. So that when we go to the administration, we're going with a unified front. That we're not going and second-guessing each other, or worse than that, being pitted one group against the other. So developing that unified front is going to be extremely important. I've been meeting meeting with Ryan, the president of staff council. In the same way, there are a lot of things on their agenda that if we as a body are supporting them, they get much more traction than if they go alone. And I think that's probably going to be the same thing with us. It'll be nice when we have an agenda item that we need to push forward and we need support, that it's not just support from the faculty, but our staff supports this. The same thing holding true with our student leaders as well. So working to strengthen all of those relationships. So not that we have to have a fight, but that if we ever get in a moment where there's any question about what we as a body, what we as a faculty desire, wish, that it's clear. There aren't any questions about that. The last thing on this particular list is my great fear about, you know, the mythical Lomas divide. It depends on who you ask. Some people say it is a gaping chasm. Some people say it's a rivulet. It's, you know, some people don't see it as a big deal. I'm one of those people that I don't care how we see it. I don't want it to get any bigger, and I don't care how small it is. I want to close it. So whatever we can do to build that connection across Lomas is going to be extremely important. This year we don't have, for example, a faculty senate president elect. Brandy Fink from North Campus has agreed to step in and take on some of those responsibilities. We are going to do things like this body is going to actually meet on North Campus, hopefully at least once a semester. Look out for that. I know it's going to be a pain in the butt because we want to come to this room, but it's important for us to move this and demonstrate that this is not just a faculty on main campus and everyone else is subordinate. That's not the way that we should operate if anyone's thinking that way. I don't think that we do. But that's something that I'm passionate about. I don't want us to make any steps backwards. And again, coming back to Pamela, you know, keeping that divide from widening, that's a Herculean effort over the last, you know, 3-4 years. And there are things out there that threaten to make that gap wider. We're going to work hard to keep that from happening, right? I'm kind of saying that like, yeah, this is what we're going to do. I'm hoping that we as a body agree that that's what we're going to do. So the report that you're about to get is the result of a number of things, right? So the observations, my own personal observations as faculty senate president-elect, information from that transition advisory team, random conversations with faculty members from different parts of our campus, really useful conversations with our university secretary. I know I've reviewed tons of documents. There was a really interesting proposal afoot once where the faculty senate's budget would be some percentage of the president's salary.
I
thought it was a great idea.
When 90% was a little excessive.
Even 9%.
I forget what the percentage was, but I have to tell you.
You said 25.
Was it 25?
Yeah, I don't know if that's true.
I think it was something like that in the original report. But when that came up during the retreat, it wasn't that, like that was poo-pooed. So,
well, so that was back. Funny. You
know, I think she heard she needs to raise her salary.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, president Soap said she'd raise her salary.
So we'll report back on that retreat in just a second. Then, of course, all of you received, and we had a remarkable response rate to our faculty senate survey. I don't remember what the exact numbers were, but it was approaching 70%, if I'm not mistaken, right? Wow. I'm very thankful for that response from everyone. And I know that there are people who you wanted to or didn't, you know, click the link wrong or whatever. I don't know if that link is still alive, but we're still soliciting input on those questions that we ask. And thank you all for your questions. You will see your questions reflected in the report that we're about to present to you. And so we decided to put together what was the first annual faculty governance retreat. That governance retreat was three parts. The first part was AF&T, COG, and the operations committee coming together, sitting down, and hashing out what we collectively thought, one, what was coming out of your survey, but also how the different groups, how was COG impacted by this? What was their, how did they think that they could help? AF&T and the like. So it was truly a collaborative faculty governance retreat. That first piece then yielded to a working lunch with the president, Regent Brown, Chancellor Roth was there, the Provost Holloway, the academic leadership for the university sat with us, and we went through all of those things. We presented to them your questions, the specific questions. Some of them were a little bit acerbic, and we couldn't ask them exactly as you asked them, if you asked them, but we got around to the questions. And so that information we then called with the help of the university secretary. We came up with five different areas of interest that will govern our agenda. And I think we have some information here. So these are the five, and we'll go through these one at a time. And the first will be campus climate and environment comments from Pamela Pyle.
So you will not be unsurprised to find that there was a lot of agreement on what the issues on campus were. And one of the major ones was communication, campus climate, morale. So I don't want to read to you what's up there, but let me fill in a little bit. So things that people thought would help campus climate, compensation was huge. And under compensation, I think it would be fair to put addressing gender inequities. So we know that we've had a few Band-Aids put on those, but as Finney and I were talking earlier, there's not been a long-term systemic approach to how to do that. So it's just been a Band-Aid here, a Band-Aid there. So that's something that will help. Social integration, I'm not going to define that because I think these are not answers. They're just things people threw out there. How do we come together on a more genuine basis outside of work, perhaps, or maybe in working situations? Faculty retention and recruitment, and also student recruitment, we felt is really pertinent to the environment for all of us. Let me go down to another one that's important, the region selection process. So as you all know, this body over the last really 10 years, some of you may remember, have been working on how to do that better, how to have faculty input, how to have a faculty regent. But I will say, and thanks, Finney, for bringing it up, that because of this body last year, the governor chose a different approach than she usually chose, and we ended up with better regents. So the only thing I can say is I'm jealous of your future relationships with the regents. I'm not going to be able to have. But we made a difference, and we made a difference in the newspapers, in the governor's administration. So does this work well? Is there something else we can do? I think that is going to be a continuation. That and the idea of, and this question was posed to President Stokes, how do we educate legislators on the need to fully fund raises? So you all remember last year, or those of you who are here, we get a dollar from the legislature, but it only covers 50 cents, right? I mean, there's a way this happens, or we need a dollar, they gave us 50 cents. I guess I should say it that way. So we need to convince them that when we get a raise, they can't pay for half of it, because we don't have a mysterious pocket that has the other $5 billion in it that we need. So those sorts of things. And then the last big bullet point I'll just point you to, strengthen shared governance. And I'm going to be fascinated to see how we do this. How do we actually strengthen the accountability of you all? You know, as Finney said, we'll take votes after you've had a chance to ask your constituents. But often, you know, we're voting our own conscience and hoping that our faculty follow that. It'd be nice if we switch that up a little bit. Branch campuses. So, because Tracy, I know, is here, and Dennis are here, right? Oh, I'm sorry. Cheryl, you're here, too. Three out of our four campuses are here. I'm not missing Taos, right? Not here. So that's one thing. I don't know that we reimburse travel expenses for them. Do our branch campus members have secure contracts, or do they have to renew a contract every year after 25 years wondering if they're getting a job? What are the collaborative opportunities? I remember branch campuses coming to me in my first presidency saying, hey, can I have a RAC grant? Correct me if I'm wrong, but at the time they couldn't do it. And it just, there were some things they couldn't be a part of, and it seems a little separatist. So that's another thing. All right, that's my speech.
And can I want to piggyback on because I think during the retreat, one of the things that we spent some time talking about was finding the resources to reimburse our colleagues, and also thinking about ways, so if someone's coming from Taos or from Gallup, and it's an evening, you know, you're here for 5 o'clock. Why don't we have space in a hotel or a dorm or some where if someone doesn't feel, especially when the weather's going to be bad, right, going back to Taos, and to come out of pocket for a hotel or something like that, we have to do a better job of facilitating that movement back and forth to campus. So thank you. And that's something that we're going to take up. The next is Brandy.
Mary has a comment.
Do we have a comment?
Yes. I just thought it was important to look at the first three bullets because, in fact, shared governance does include inclusive participation and, of course, an open environment in which to engage in deliberation and decision making. And so, having been on the policy committee and knowing that several committees were very much involved in the development of the respectful campus policy, we do, you know, want to ensure as faculty that we're upholding that in all spaces of the university. Part of that is addressing structural inequities along racial, ethnic, gender, sexuality, different abilities. And in doing that, you know, our aspiration is to reduce workplace tensions and hostilities. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't think we want to do comment after each one of these, do we? I don't think so. Let's work through them, and then at the end we can open up the floor for comments. We're a little ahead of schedule. I'd like to keep us there. So the image and public face of the university, Brandy Fink is going to help us with that.
Yeah, so I'll talk about this one. And what was nice about the retreat, too, is we heard these things echoed from each of our members of leadership as well. So we had excellent consensus on supporting these initiatives. And so the first one here, we were really concerned, and we think it's an important focus of our public-facing, the public face of the in the outward representation of the university to the committee or to the community, sorry. And so working on what we can do to develop and support the initiatives to increase enrollment. With the new Vice President for Enrollment Management Services, this may present a unique opportunity to be working on that as well. And then also support the safety of students, but I think also faculty and staff, because we are an urban campus and that this is an issue. I know my colleagues on the North Campus who come in to the hospital for, you know, a middle of the night shift have had cars vandalized and things like that, which is, you know, an important concern for all of us. So not just the safety of the students, but of the faculty and staff. As well. And then focusing on creating new and support existing opportunities for community engagement. As part of the grand challenges, I have been on the speaking tour in the community. I think the president is using this initiative as a way to really reach out to the community, and I am happy to participate in things like that. Yesterday in the Southwest Airlines magazine, there was a really nice article written about the University of New Mexico and some of our research initiatives and things like that. So these are nice endeavors that are undergoing. And then create and support existing opportunities for community building on campus. So making sure that we all feel like we're a community and working together toward the common goals and that we all feel supported in doing that. And then lastly, create and support existing opportunities to work with the legislature. And this, I think it's important for us to kind of understand who our legislators are as well. I had an opportunity, so did Dr. Valdez, a couple weeks ago to present before the Legislative Health and Human Services Committee. And so one thing that Katie Wickiewicz and I did is we both explained that we're both clinical psychologists, but I'm in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and those departments are in health sciences. And departments of psychology are on Central Campus. And the committee found that incredibly informative. You know, so a lot of our legislators don't have advanced degrees or college education. So this notion of what the university is and what it actually looks like is completely foreign to them. And so doing what we can to reach out and just explain this is how it works in a non-threatening, you know, way as just plain English as possible, I think goes a long way. I was surprised at how appreciative the committee was for just explaining some of the organizational structures of the university. And then what we can do to provide them necessary information for making policy decisions that affect the whole state. I think those are really good opportunities to work with our legislator, that legislative body that will then come back and support the university going forward when we're asking for funding supports and things like that.
Fantastic. Our next item is compliance with university policy. Dr. Lopez.
So a common theme was the structural inequities that were referenced before and how these are simultaneous. It's about race, gender, class, sexual orientation, status, disability, and how all of these are simultaneous and how they map onto all of these issues that we care about, whether it has to do with the relationships that we have with administration, whether it has to do with the ways in which administrators at the highest levels are chosen and what is the role of faculty voice. Is there going to be an opportunity for appointments to these high-level search committees, et cetera, that is actually representing faculty, not selected by administration solely? How can we foster some kind of consistency and accountability in terms of compliance with university policies, whether that's tenure and promotion, whether that's search committees, whether that's some other, you know, hiring committees, et cetera, and existing and trying to reinforce the idea that we want to create a collaborative governance structure where we are working with administration in concert with our common goals and our common values. So a lot of these kind of point to the need for accountability and the need for addressing power sharing in a way that, again, captures the existing inequalities along all those lines that I mentioned earlier. So I don't want to necessarily read everything, but it just summarizes some of the opportunities we have for enhancing the ways in which we can make sure that our university policies are being followed.
Okay. Thank you, Nancy. Dr. Valdez?
Yes, the next set of discussion items that there was a great deal of consensus around really had to do with improving the morale and well-being of faculty on all of our campuses. And obviously the biggest issue and item was how do we maintain competitive compensation packages that include salary and benefits that make some sense. Part of that discussion revolved around the need for a better budgeting system within the university, as well as was mentioned earlier, better recognition by the state legislature of what fraction of the university's budget the state is actually investing in. Recognition that we need multiple sources of revenue and resources to increase our research support and to also to support our recruitment and retention of faculty. The recognition that turnover is a costly item for this institution, and especially for the health sciences, was a clear concern and issue that affects not only the well-being but also the morale of our faculty. And with morale, I want to encourage you as senators to be examples of pulling us together for various kinds of social interactions, whether it's through formal events like the freshman convocation that took place recently, or at the University Club welcome you event. I would have loved to have seen all of your beautiful faces there enjoying the music and the good time that some of us who actually went there had. So the more that we can create that environment, the more likely it is we can increase our well-being as well as our morale. And to a large extent, that falls to us as senators of the faculty to encourage our constituents and to be examples of trying to create community.
All right, I'm going to take the next one, which is communication strategy. I'll move that up there. So I think this kind of piggybacks what on other people are saying. We definitely want to increase that communication with that higher-level administration. So, faculty to administration, governance to faculty. And one thing I would like to reach out to everybody as well is to provide a suggestion. So you could reach out to me, Rebecca Blankley, rblankley at salu.unm.edu, or certainly provide suggestions to Finney. So we definitely do this well. I just have to give the accolades to Rick because he's the best, the only way I communicate with Faculty Senate, and has taught me how to do that. And so that's been super helpful. But for those of us that don't do that, give us some suggestions on a better way we could provide communication with each other. So, for example, I think a great number one step would be how we're going to deliver this plan so everyone can see it. As we just demonstrated by Finney asking Rick to show him the crawl of all of the appointees, that's a great example to try to figure out how we can better, be able to data mine our faculty senate notes, who these senators are, that kind of thing. I think that that's like the first step. And so we would love your suggestions on how to do a better job. We want that to be bi-directional for sure, and definitely wanted to provide better ways to communicate with the provost and president. I think one example of what we do is invite them here to these meetings. I think we're lucky because we have access to those people, but most faculty feel that they do not. And the other last bullet being strategic planning. I wanted to follow back up with your section for morale, if I may. That last one was also OEO transparency. I know on the HSC side we've had multiple situations where we've had students get into situations with these OEO reports, and they simply do not provide us any feedback or follow-up with what happened with that situation. I know me personally, I had a student situation, and I think we got a report 2.5 years later about what happened there. So that's another great example that we're going to try to hold some accountability or just get some more information from the OEO office on how we can share in that experience and really make that better for our students and including ourselves as faculty members. And last, also piggybacking on Robert's section of morale, I am the person that tries to put together these get-togethers, and nobody usually comes. But Robert did come last week on Friday. And I have to say, I've never been to the University Club. It really was kind of fun. I'll continue to probably try to put those shout-outs at. And they're exactly what one would expect them to be. We just meet different people from different backgrounds and just enjoy the night. Nancy was also there. And Liz. Right? And so really just a fun time, fun event. And I would encourage us all to partake. And last on that, I always love other suggestions of where we could meet. Doesn't have to just be a bar. It could be a coffee shop. Or a hike. Any ideas, please send them my way. Yes?
I was just going to say, having them after our faculty senate meeting, when many of us are already here,
good idea.
Would be helpful.
Awesome.
Get off in the middle of the week at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
We're already staying late, so good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll try to book one maybe next month.
Okay. So I'm next with immediate concerns, and during the retreat, there was a process of distilling down what would be the immediate priorities, with everything that you've already seen being an important priority for the Senate. And so the four that were identified, faculty governance in the environment, that includes collective bargaining, but it refers to broadening and widening participation in all aspects of decision-making in the university. People feeling informed and engaged in decision-making, increasing communication and feedback channels. Some folks have already mentioned that. In regards to the impact of unionization on faculty governance, again, there was discussion about the relationship or role vis-a-vis the Senate and unionization, and the consensus on that was that the Senate would publicize the process, make information available so that folks can make informed decisions. And on IPRA, there's been some folks are already aware of this, some challenges, I think, in terms of knowing when to turn over notes and records related to decision-making in governance and research. So that will be an ongoing discussion. And finally, Dr. Coleman already mentioned the discussions around increasing the budget so that Well, so that the priorities that we decide upon, in fact, can be enacted with some sort of, you know, monetary support.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for that. So I have several discussion items, and they are things for us to think about, not necessarily to discuss here, but to think about what if we want to do some of these things. And these are not like, this isn't an exhaustive list. So there were suggestions that came forward, like we should move to a bigger room. I confess my bias for this room. I don't know if we need more space. We have a lot of empty chairs as it sits. But I know that the argument is if we are in a larger venue, more people might come. I'd like the moment that we fill this room and there's not a seat, I think we should be out of here. But I don't think that we have that problem yet, but it's something to consider. So it's not a closed door on that. If we need to move, let's discuss it. And if we so as a group choose that that's what we want to do, that's what we'll do. Teleconferencing, we want to make sure that I keep using the Taos example. So if our colleagues in Taos, if it's snowing, I don't want them trying to get here. I'd rather have them teleconferencing in so that they can have access. However, we have to balance that against, you know, winding up having a meeting with like me and Rick and everybody else is in their, you know, shorts in the basement. I don't think that's going to happen. You know,
having just been on the curriculum committee, there is teleconferencing for the members of the committee who are at other campuses, not just for anyone.
Right. Yeah. So
we might consider the circumstances for that who might be eligible.
Right. I completely agree with that. So, again, something that we can talk about, how do we expand that in a way that's meaningful so that we don't lose. I think there's some synergy when you have people in the room. And, you know, I want us to maintain that, but I also recognize that we need to open it up to as many people as possible. There's even a suggestion out there for changing the date of the Faculty Senate meeting. Tuesday afternoon sucks for me as a soccer coach, but that's okay. I mean, my kids get a day off. But if there is some stomach for moving this, that is one. It's not. I don't think it's anything we can do immediately. It would have to be something that we do, you know, down the road. But even our meeting date and time, we can consider all options. And if there's stomach for these things, I think we can, you know, maybe move on some of them. I have a couple more things that I want to mention. So for our next meeting, before we get there, we'll send out a draft of this stuff that we've just been given. Have you share that with your colleagues, tweak it, you know, add to it, subtract from it, and then hopefully we'll have more of a discussion at our next meeting about what our agenda should look like for the academic year. Ideally, this is something that we're talking about in the spring, so that when we go into the fall semester, the agenda's already set, if that makes sense. But you can't get all of your cake at the same time. You get what you can when you get it. We'll build that vision in place as we go along. We've talked about the election process. I want to introduce our council chairs who are here. Are you the only one here, Frank?
I may be the only one.
You may be the only one. Okay.
Mike is here too.
Mike's back there.
Well, yeah, right. Good point.
And Brandy. Well,
yeah, so we're just missing Charlie and David. Yeah.
All right. So we have, but they let me know that they, you know, they had conflicts and couldn't be here. The reason I wanted to introduce our council chairs is because we're going to continue to discuss a structure where individual members of OPS would be working with the council chairs to work with the committees. Rather than all of that funneling up through one person, again, I'm not sure how you ever got it done, but you did.
I probably didn't get it done.
But to try to, because I know I can't do it. You got to know your strengths and weaknesses, right? But to spread that out so that we have that back and forth and more people at the table for these conversations, right? And so we haven't hashed out completely yet how that's going to look, but the structure would allow those council chairs to be more empowered in the decision-making about committee appointees and things like that. So we're going to continue to work on that. I think I've lost my place. I have faculty
special.
Oh, special emphasis. Okay. So we sent out a blurb about the special emphasis for this particular ops. Like each year, I imagine that our operations committee would have one thing that like kind of is all on the radar when they don't have anything else to do. I don't know. But we feel pretty passionate. I think I'm speaking for all of us, that finding support for our additional support for our junior faculty is extremely important. One of the reasons that we're losing people so much is that sometimes you get here, it's just not the place that you thought it was going to be. You don't meet up with your colleagues. You don't have these kind of social opportunities that we talked about. How do we build that? If you go into our faculty constitution, bullet number 8 is the welfare of our faculty. And nobody's going to do that for us if we don't do it. And so we have to look out for our junior colleagues. We're going to look for additional resources, not just for their research, but for social opportunities as well. Some of you, everyone who's heard me talk about this has heard me talk about Popejoy. There are empty seats in Popejoy. I think that every junior faculty member that's new on our campus, if there's an empty seat in Popejoy, they should be able to sit there, right? I don't see why, if there's an empty seat at a basketball game and we've got, you know, 3 junior professors and they want to go to that, why not? Build that community as people come through the door so that later on you have a paying customer who's going to go to Popejoy, who's going to go to the football game or the basketball game or what have you. I think we collectively have to think about creative, low-cost, no-cost, or cost-neutral strategies to put more on the plates of our young colleagues so that they have a successful time here at our university. So we're going to seek to find, I'm going to try that Popejoy thing. I don't know if it's going to work. They probably kicked me out, but you know, I'm going to ask. And if we can't, why can't we find the resources to provide subvention for those kinds of things, right? Finally, the ceremonial life of the university. And I come from, many of us come from, probably most of us, come from different universities around the country. One of the things that, you know, I lost a job on this campus because my answer to one of the questions, I don't think I've lost a job, but I don't think that the search committee was at all impressed when they asked, what do you think we need more of on our campus? And I said, frat parties. They were like, what? Right? And I don't literally mean frat parties. But our students, come Friday, they're gone. The social life and the traditions that many of us brought from our other institutions. I went to the Virginia Military Institute and the University of Virginia, and I first taught at Texas A&M. So I'm kind of like dyed in the wool when it comes to tradition. The ceremonial life of our university doesn't begin with the people who pass through it. It's the people who are here the entire time. I've seen any number of classes of students come through since 2005 here at this institution. When we as a faculty champion that part of life on our campus, and we ourselves participate in it, I think it's better for our students. So, for example, when the next time that we have a new faculty senate president, at spring graduation, when the mace is placed at that spring graduation, the new faculty senate president will carry that mace out. The old will bring it in, and the new will take it out. Building in small things like that, doing freshman family day, those things. We as a faculty, we can't complain if we don't participate. I think that's what Bob was alluding to, that it's time for us to start investing into the ceremonial life of the university as well. I would love to see everybody at a football game. I know it ain't going to happen, but I would really like to see that for us to have more fun and have a greater time as faculty. With that said, I know some of you are like, we got to get rid of this guy. He wants us to go to football game. That's not quite true. Last two things. We have a couple of opportunities that I hope that you will agree that we should pursue. And one of those is to establish the New Mexico Association of Faculty Governance Leaders, where we would pull faculty governance leaders from New Mexico State, from Highlands, all over our universe, all over our state, to come together on our campus to discuss issues across our state as faculty governance leaders. I could see that being a really remarkable opportunity to share and build strategies with our colleagues. And then a similar council, the Mountain West Council of Faculty Governance. So it's the MWC Faculty Governance Council. Right. So put that in your hat to think about, you know, as we lead as a university, I think that means doing just that. Our faculty governance leads, right? Nobody else in the state has thought to do this. Let's take the lead. Nobody else in our conference has thought to do this. Let's take the lead. That's the way I feel about it, right? So with that said, our agenda is exhausted. However, we did have that report, and I want, if you have any comments, if we could have some. Well, it's not adjusted. It's not exhausted yet. I'm wrong. We have new business. I don't think we have anybody for public comment. Do we have anyone here for public comment? No public comment. All right. So the next item on our agenda is new business. And under that, I think I have the latitude to open the floor for questions and comments about other things that we've talked about today. Am I right, parliamentarian person?
Yeah, you can call for discussion.
I can call for general discussion. Yes, please.
So when you held the retreat and the upper administrators were there, how did they receive these comments and this feedback? What was the tenor?
Yeah, I'll let my colleagues
answer that. I'd love to answer that if I may. It was actually shockingly similar. Their agenda was almost aligned to ours, which we had commented on that we'd almost never seen before. So that was amazing.
Yeah.
They took notes, and the branch resonated with them as well. Nothing that we said made anyone snicker. Paul Roth was taking notes. I mean, it really felt it was a very positive experience.
So finance. College safety, what were their other highlights?
But they communication, morale, they're aware of that, compensation, they're aware of all those issues.
Hugely about compensation and retention.
Yeah, they're on our side for that, I would say. It's just that if we don't get the funding from the legislature, we're at odds with them. Because where does it go?
Yeah. All right, I have two somewhat separate questions. One is, I'm concerned, of course, about the records, you know, handwritten and so on. Does that apply? How does that get requested? I mean, if the committee or whatever doesn't get back people's written, handwritten comment, where are they to come from when they are being requested?
Let
me ask the other one, and now I forgot. I'm sorry.
Was it about IPRA though? Was it about writing records?
Right. In the athletic council, does the council keep the members' written records in order to produce a report? Because, like, when we are doing a tenure and promotion case, nobody takes the members' written records to do anything.
So you're saying, how do they get a hold of it?
Yeah.
Well, that's where the rub is, because they literally, Mike had to email faculty and say, send me the notes that you took during the meeting. I've never heard that happening before. So you can imagine, you could get an IPRA request that says, I want your handwritten notes from that meeting. Now,
send me that paper you just wrote on.
Yeah.
It's true, right?
So I could ask tomorrow to see the notes that you wrote today.
So he has to ask officially by writing the Inspection of Public Records Act, officer of the school, write a letter, he or she, and then they ask. Now, when I've been IPRA, it's usually about communications, email, and they're satisfied if I don't have anything. I mean, so I'll say, Dodi and I used to get IPRA, but he and I used to speak, so we didn't have any paper trail, I guess, because if he yelled at me, it was always in person. But so that's how it functions. But this is a whole new level with notes.
No.
I mean, presumably someone keeps minutes.
Yes.
Or recordings?
Well, we have recording today, of course. But,
yeah. So let me explain how, maybe put some flesh on the bone here, right? So let's say that the three of us are having a discussion about whether we're going to promote you. Mm-hmm. And you start out, and I'm like, no way. He's got a Red Bull shirt on, no way. Not happening, right? But Pamela convinces me that I'm wrong, right? She and I are having a vocal conversation about it. We haven't taken any notes, but Brandy down there, the pack rat that she is, is jotting down everything that Pamela and I just said. Right? So when the IPRA request comes for information about that, I say, I don't have anything. I didn't say Red Bull. Red Bull what? That wasn't me. But her handwritten notes are now IPRA-able. Right? it is a can of worms that has far-reaching implications for your research. Yeah. You've got the cure for cancer.
Patents.
I want to see it.
Right.
I approve it. And by the law as it stands, you got to turn that over to me. If you are conducting research, as I am, on the Ku Klux Klan and at Texas A&M University, that's not even here in the state, and someone says you're using a university computer to do that work, Texas A&M is going to be seriously ticked off when they find out that I'm, you know, jotting down the names that are in the Klan robes and that they match up with the street names in College Station, right? Nobody's going to want to hear that. And what that means for me in terms of academic freedom and research is that I can walk into that archive right now and say, hey, I want to go to Box X. They don't make me sit out in the lobby and wait for that. I get to go back in the stacks and do that. That access will be cut off to me immediately if my research came to light before I had a chance to write it out in a way that makes some sense.
And Vinny, how do you think we would address this? I think that our lawyer is very conservative in her interpretation. Is that correct?
It's true. So the advice before 2013 was the advice that we had been going on. The Attorney General went back, the new Attorney General went back, and there was the idea that your notes from a meeting would be protected because you have a level of expectation that those notes would be protected and that they could stymie debate, they could stymie discussion, and therefore, as a personnel matter, those notes would be protected. No longer. That is no longer the case. That is no longer the guidance, at least, that we've been given. But I don't want us to rush off and to our next faculty or to our departmental meetings and go, the house is on fire, IPRAs, everything's... But that is the slope that we're on. We're doing everything that we can to get off that slippery slope in terms of guidance. Yes, sir?
Can we avoid this term slippery slope?
Yes.
IPRA exists for a reason. Okay? Because if you're going to start saying that free speech is a bad thing in some instances, and good thing in others. So IPRA exists for a reason. So we have to understand what it means and have, if we're performing an official duty, we have to be careful what we say.
Yeah, I agree.
It's going to go on public record. But
what?
A public employee. So,
well, let's be clear about.
Don't say slippery slope because tomorrow in the journal.
It'll. I don't want to retract that because I actually do mean it. I think that at some point IPRA can be weaponized in ways that the law wasn't intended, and that's what I mean by slippery slope. Is that we want to have, for this meeting, for example, technically we wouldn't have to comply with the Open Meetings Act. But we're going to because we think as a faculty that we should. We want to have open communications, but we don't want to stymie discussion, and we want to protect our academic freedom. So that my research, I don't feel that my research should be made public until I, the researcher, deem that that's the moment it should be made public. And as it stands right now, I don't have that autonomy. So it's not that it's a slippery slope in terms that IPRA is wrong. It's how IPRA can be used and interpreted that I think can be problematic. And we can certainly debate that. And if I need to retract for the public record, slippery slope, I'll do that. But the truth is, this is a can of worms that has far-reaching implications beyond just the binaries of is it right or wrong.
This is an issue of interpretation of a law, not a negation of the law. And so as you have different attorneys and different offices who are new, as we have new people here at the university, we have new people in the state, they bring their own sets of interpretations or approaches to interpreting legal statutes. And so what we're dealing with now is really new interpretations or different interpretations of previous guidance.
Right.
And that's what he means by slippery slope.
Yeah, and the law itself has not changed.
I want to say something. I'm Stephanie Bean. I work in the university libraries. And I want to make it really clear that as far as like research and what you look up and access to information, that the American Libraries Association lobbies powerfully in Washington, D.C. to protect what you look up what you research, and that's very different than like an Open Meetings Act, because I just consulted this summer. Let's not conflate the two. That what you look up, for instance, like the Broadband Act and broadband access in public libraries, what we do here in university, I love what you were talking about your own research. That's very different than kind of what you're talking about with Open Meetings Act.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I saw Lee, and then I saw one other hand, and then Liz. But the other person who had their hand up right in here? I'm sorry. Okay, Lee?
Lee Graham, Department of Medicine. So, you know, the laws that are written, the first version of the law that's passed isn't necessarily perfect. In fact, as lawyers get their hands on it and try to reinterpret it and change what they claim it means, and the judiciary agrees or disagrees with them, it means that the law needs to be revised so that it says what is okay and what is not okay and what is protected and what is not protected. Of course, that also is going to be challenged and polls are going to be looked for going forward, but a law is not necessarily done when it's passed. It needs to be a living document that is changed as interpretations change, as case law changes, and as it's used or misused. So, you know, one of the things we could talk to legislators about if we go up on UNM Day this year is about IPRA and about these misuses that we perceive, and whether they'd be interested in sponsoring a law that makes it more robust.
Liz?
Thank you. Liz Hutchison, Department of History. And I wanted to just circle back to both Vinny and Stephanie's comments just around work product and academic freedom, sort of reasonable expectation. I'm really grateful that Operations is working on this with Council, but I would also urge a greater participation of the Research Committee and Academic Freedom and Tenure, specifically because of the question of protecting research and subjects, which the Institutional Review Board already makes us go through a process and sign agreements about exactly how we protect the confidentiality of our subjects. And it seems to me that since that comes from a federal mandate, it would be relevant to a discussion about a state law and whether the two are in conflict with one another. For me, what the IRB makes me sign about confidentiality will rule. The area of governance, I think, is kind of a different set of issues, and I'm really eager to see where we land on that with the change in interpretation.
So as it stands now, so you know where we are with this, COG, AF&T, and ops are at the table talking about this. We had not thought to include the research committee as something we'll take under advisement, right? But we are working collectively. It's not just me or, you know, it's a group of us. It's a collective effort to address this. And we're going to move forward, and I think have some other information for you as we move forward. Isley.
So, riffing on what I said before, I have in the past been involved in getting legislation submitted and passed. And if you have connections, as I do, with specific legislators, and I know Pamela does, you might be interested in this subject and willing to sponsor a revision of the law.
GRC. We could talk about this on the Governmental Relations Committee.
Okay.
Yeah, really good idea. Yeah, really good idea.
Any other comments? Yes.
I remember my second question, which is a quick one. Has anybody actually calculated the cost of recruiting?
Faculty or students?
Faculty.
Said to be $250,000.
Oh, wow.
And the cost of one leaving. Isn't that like a million?
It's about
$250,000. That's like a million.
Somebody should put those numbers to them.
That's a good idea.
Or the legislature.
I like that, yeah.
If you don't increase the salaries, you know there's another cost you're paying on the other side, or whatever.
I got that, yeah. Yeah, I got it.
versus how much it costs to reuse it. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Okay.
Anybody else?
There's a hand in the
back. Yes.
I was just adding to that, and in the list of, I can't remember which specific communities were addressing faculty morale or salaries. I think there are a couple different communities that looked at. And I don't see the word compression, and I think that that's.
Compression?
Compression.
Yeah.
It's a major issue, and I yep. also think you might want to talk to the legal about it, because I know that in our department, we have a gender equity kerfuffle, I guess I would call it. And, we all just kind of stomped on it. They were like, you don't have enough information. And it required a lot of work to find the women who were coming forward with a complaint, and it became a legal matter. And I think it might be a question to put to legal to say, how are you going to deal with faculty morale when you have groups of women in departments and schools that are, you know, able to prove that they're paid less instead of just firing on them or making them take it, you know, instead of saying, well, get a lawyer and talk about it. I mean, is there a way to actually have a discourse about it that doesn't require actually taking legal action to be first? And I think that that's a question I would put to the ops committee. Like, what are our options as a faculty if we collectively realize as a group of underrepresented and underpaid folks that we are being marginalized?
We did talk about gender inequities in terms of a long-term solution, Nora. Is that sort of where you're going with that as well?
Yeah, I guess we're going to see maybe we're talking to you about it as well.
And for sure, compaction is huge. Yeah.
And it's interesting that compression winds up being used as the excuse
yes.
for not addressing the inequities.
Right.
It's a remarkable circle.
Yeah,
you know, I think with the you know that's also a conversation, I think, for the provost. Because at some point, this is not going to be a bottom-up solution. You know, I'm sure I have people who are better versed in economics in here than I am. I'm just an economics undergrad person. But the economics of it are interesting because the way that you address it is by raising the floor across the department and then doing your metrics for how you're going to address the inequities. But you can't do it unless you also raise the floor. And that requires the provost to actually have thought through that in terms of the long-range hiring and budgeting so that some percentage of our hiring has to go to raising the floor across the university, right? So it would not have been popular, but the 2% or how it turned to 4%? 3%, but it turns out like we eat up some of that with... but the raise that we received this fall, in theory, some of that should have gone to raising the floor and then gone to individuals. But that's not, we basically raised the level of individual salaries and didn't address the compression.
Right.
So that it's going to take, unfortunately, I don't know a way to fix that without a huge influx of money in a short term. There are no short term fixes for that. But we have to build in a long term fix. It takes a long time to compress it. It may take some time to spread it back out. Yes?
Yeah. Just building off of that, is there a committee that's just compiling data? I mean, everybody's salary is, you know, you can just look it up, right?
Right.
So just to have some graphs. How long have you been here? What are you getting paid? What, you know, just to see where people are at.
The university libraries had some people that worked very hard on that, and as far as I know, it didn't go anywhere.
No.
We have people...
Yeah, the data.
That might be something.
The data's already there.
The committee could put together just to take a proactive look at it.
We have people. We just have people whose entire research agenda is that within the library and that are on Diversity Council too that have been looking at this for a very long time and to bounce off what Bonnie said, I think they feel very marginalized in their voices because it hasn't gone anywhere for a very long time. And I'm actually very excited. When you opened up with what this Ops Committee's agenda has set out to do. I think this is going to be a fantastic year. I'm really excited.
We'll work hard at it, and that's I think the data we've studied. I saw a memo addressing an issue that is prevalent on this campus regarding African Americans and hiring on this campus from 1982. I was graduating from high school, and we still have not addressed those things, right? So at some point, we have to get well, I'm not going to use any of my southern slang. Sometimes you have to do something or get off the pot, right? And I think that's where we've been. We've been on this pot for a long time. I think it's going to take a collective faculty voice saying, we got it. Let's get something done, right? We hopefully will meet with some success, but we will, as that's part of our agenda, we'll work at that. Yes.
So having been to several unionization meetings last year, this was something that came up a lot, and there were examples of how unions established at other universities with people coming from those universities, how they addressed it. And I would encourage anybody who is concerned, if there are any more meetings prior to unionization, to go and get some information about how that was addressed by unions.
There's a question.
Okay. So do we have, yes.
Liz, sorry, next to compensation, this is Liz Hutchison again. Next to compensation and IPRA, this seems really small, but since you brought it up and spoke against it, I just wanted people to think about where we meet and what it means. And it's not an opposition to us meeting in this beautiful room, which is really accessible to our guests and strolls and very useful for the university secretary's office. But having visited the Senate a lot as a non-senator and also in support of holding these meetings on North Campus on occasion and the work to bring in our branch campus colleagues and so forth, I would just say one of the reasons we were able to pull together and pull off the vote of no confidence was the accessibility of organizing meetings that were held by the Senate in the sub. Now, it doesn't have to be the sub, but I'm just offering that the room is large enough to hold all of us, but we do have colleagues who really want to weigh in on specific issues and may wish to speak. My experience and what I hear from people is that this is not the most accessible space, and maybe changing the time would help. There are a lot of fixes that could happen. So I just wanted people to think more broadly about that, whether it's a possibility and might bring it, more people into contact with the Senate who are not going to come over here and come upstairs. And so that's just a vote for the other side.
Okay. And if I could just piggyback on that, I think the idea is we want to increase engagement. So for a lot of faculty who might be new to the campus or may have been disengaged, it might provide a different message if we're meeting outside of the administration building. So that's super important. So the last thing I'll mention is that if we do want to make a change in the teleconferencing, our bylaws have to change. So that is going to require an action item and a vote that has to go through the proper channels. And again, accessibility is the issue. It is about making sure that people who may not be able to make it can make it for a legitimate reason, not because I'm suntanning on the beach or something. But the idea that we want to increase engagement, that's a vehicle.
And I think accessibility might also include parking for people coming off campus.
It's huge.
All right. Fair enough. So at when it's appropriate, we will bring those things forward as action items, and then we'll have our proper motions and seconds and discussion and votes. And as a body, we'll decide what it is collectively we want to do. This is not a dictatorship, but for right now, we're going to stay here. But we'll figure out if we're going to move as soon as possible. Fair enough. Is there any public comment? Any faculty who are visiting who have anything that they would like to add? Any public comment? If there's no public comment, our agenda is exhausted and we are adjourned.